Welcome to Not Two Reads, an audio library of revolutionary texts. Scripting the Change. Selected writings of Anuradha Gandhi. Working Class Woman. Making the Invisible Visible. All over the world, the participation of women in working class struggles has gone up. Since the percentage of women workers is going up, they are becoming an increasingly important component of the working class. International capitalism has intensified its use of patriarchy to exploit women, not only in their own countries, but in third world countries too. As working class struggles get intensified, the role of working women in these struggles will also become important. The woman proletariat must play its historical role to liberate themselves from the chains of imperialism and bureaucrat capitalism, and gender-based exploitation as well. But in India, since the vast majority of toiling women are in the rural areas, it is the contribution of peasant and tribal women that has been and will be most significant in the struggle to bring an end to feudal, capitalist exploitation, and patriarchal oppression. Yet there are very large numbers of women who live by their toil, outside the sphere of agriculture. By their sheer number, they constitute a force which is yet to be organized and released. The length and depth of feudal tradition in India has kept the masses of poor women in chains of bondage and without self-worth. They toil and they labor, but are hardly recognized. The composition of working women in India varies from that of other countries, including other Asian countries. Women constitute 40-50% of the labor force in countries like Germany and Norway. They constitute a little more than a quarter in India. While industry hardly employs 7.5% of India's working women, even in countries like Korea, Malaysia, and Singapore, women were almost half the workforce in manufacture. In Indonesia, 12%, and in the Philippines, 17% of women's labor force were in industry. And in India, most of the non-agricultural women's labor force is in the informal sector. The invisibility of women's work, its undervaluation and perception that it is a secondary line of operation, is sharply evident in the industrial sector. Indeed, it is a matter of serious concern for all of us who are concerned with women's liberation and revolution that the working class woman and their contribution to the working class movement is so neglected. The resurgence of the women's movement in the late 1970s and the consequent growth in women's studies helped to focus studies on the invisible woman due to the existing ruling class policies. But their contribution to struggles is still mostly hidden in the yellowed, brittle pages of political journals and magazines, while their experiences lie scattered in the chokis and batis of workers around the country. The task of making their contribution to the trade union movement and to the broader working class movement visible has only now begun. This paper first deals with the colonial period, tracing the entry of women into the modern working class and their struggles. In the next section, it deals with the broad changing trends in the women's movement, especially post-1947, considering the reasons for these changes. The paper also covers the impact of protective legislation, the role of trade unions, and the struggles women have undertaken. Finally, we have taken up various issues that have come up in the context of the working class movement, which the women's movement should also consider. Woman in the Working Class. History and Trends. The Colonial Period. Destruction of handicraft industry. In 1834-35, Marx wrote, quote, "The misery hardly finds parallel in the history of commerce. The bones of the cotton weavers are bleaching the plains of India," end quote. An important proportion of the cotton weavers and spinners of yarn in pre-colonial India were women, and they too were victims of the colonial policy that destroyed the widespread handicraft industry in the country. The destruction of this handicraft industry severely affected women's role in production. In the pre-capitalist economy, the family was the unit of production both in agricultural and in artisan households, and women contributed considerably to the productive activity in artisan households too, though their role and responsibility varied in the different regions. In many areas, they marketed what their families produced too. Quote, "The decline in women's employment was a part of the general process of loss of industrial employment," end quote, that affected the entire Indian population during the 19th and early 20th century. The once flourishing cottage industries in India suffered a severe setback, quote, "due to the rapacious exploitation by the East India Company, the tariff barriers introduced to protect British factory manufactured goods, and the competition from imported and mill-made yarn," end quote. The decline of textiles, metal products and services by potters and blacksmiths affected women's industrial employment adversely. The burden of the population shifted towards agriculture, and the proportion of women dependent on agriculture for their subsistence increased. The increased burden on agriculture meant underemployment and impoverishment. Women migrated with men where they found work opportunities. They migrated as indentured labor to other British colonies in Africa and Pacific Islands. Modern industry started emerging in the second half of the 19th century itself, but the slow pace of industrialization meant that the absolute number and proportion of the female population that got employment in these industries was too small to arrest the decline in the participation of women in non-agricultural occupations. Growth of modern industry. In the first phase of the growth of modern industry, many women and children were employed in the manual and semi-manual operations in textile mills, jute mills, and in mines. They were also employed in large numbers in tea and later coffee plantations started by British and Indian capitalists. Thus, women joined the ranks of the modern proletariat from the second half of the 19th century. In the colonial period, women constituted an important portion of the working class. In the 1920s, for example, women constituted 20% of the total workers in the textile industry. They were also employed in large numbers in the cotton pressing and ginning industries. In Greater Bombay alone, out of a total factory employment of 2.1 lakh in 1927, approximately 40,000 were women. A large number of women were also employed in the mines. In 1901 itself, 30,488 women were working in mines. In 1921, 38% of the mine workers were women. In 1951, 1.09 lakh women were employed in mines, and they comprised about one-fifth of the total workforce in mines. Women worked as loaders in the coal mines and as cleaners and sorters in manganese mines. Though the largest number of women were employed in coal mines, their proportion in manganese and iron ore mines, 43.9% and 38.2%, was higher. Similarly, women constituted a large proportion of the workers in tea and coffee plantations, both in Assam and South India. They constituted over 45% of the plantation labor, and several lakh women were employed in these plantations. Besides, in urban areas, women began to be employed in municipalities as scavengers and sweepers, and in the railways. Thus, though the total proportion of female employment in industry was low, women constituted an important and militant section of the modern working class in the colonial period. Post-1947 period. Rapid decline in women's work participation. In this period, employment in the organized sector expanded and diversified as new industries started coming up. But in this period, the proportion of women's employment started falling, and there was a decline in women's total employment till 1971. It is in the decade of the 1980s that women's participation in non-household industry and in the service sector has increased. One of the most important reasons for this decline in women's employment in industry is the rapid decline in the handicraft industry after 1947. The expansion of the agro-processing factories affected women in the traditional industries like oil pressing, rice pounding, tanning, and leather products and tobacco processing. Since the largest proportion of women in the non-agricultural occupations were in the domestic cottage industry, the decline in this industry affected women's employment. The growth of organized markets and big intermediaries affected women who marketed products of household industry. Hence, women's employment in the service sector also declined. The second reason for the decline in women's employment was the retrenchment of large numbers of women workers from the modern industrial sector. Though it is in the British period itself that the process of reducing women in the factories and mines began, it became more rapid after 1950. Women began to be retrenched due to the following reasons: mechanization, automation, and rationalization. This has affected women workers most of all. Women's lack of education, the lack of opportunities to learn new technical skills, means that they were the first to be thrown out when manual or semi-manual operations were automized, e.g., the introduction of high-speed spinning and winding machines led to women being retrenched. Even in modern industries like pharmaceuticals, new super-fast filling, sealing, and labeling machines meant that recruitment of women was curtailed. The same process has been repeated in the jute industry, and the coir and tobacco industries too. As a result, the total number of women employed in factories declined in the 1960s. Protective legislation. Though the trade union movement demanded and got laws passed that protected women, it did nothing to stop the retrenchment of women due to these very laws. The various protective legislations were used by employers to stop the recruitment of women initially, and then directly retrenched them, e.g., with the ban on night shift employment for women, women began to be replaced by men in the textile industry. The ban on employing women in underground work and mines, the 1957 award equalizing the wages of women and men workers, the restriction on how much load a woman can carry, all affected women in the mines. In the jute industry too, the restrictions on load affected women's employment. To circumvent the other facilities, etc., employers stopped recruiting women or restricted the number of women to be employed. In the case of the BD industry, they shifted operations from the factory/workshop to the home. The BD rolling industry is probably one of the first industries in which the shift from the organized to the unorganized domestic sector took place. The fact is that capitalists have spent very little on the benefits and facilities that have to be provided to women. They have ignored or circumvented these laws, and yet they have retrenched women and curtailed their recruitment in the names of these laws. The failure of the trade union movement to prevent the retrenchment of women due to the above two reasons is, in fact, the most important cause for the decline of women in modern industry and the marginalization of women from the industrial sector in the post-1947 period. Thus, from being an important component of the proletariat in the colonial period, women became a marginal force in the modern manufacturing industries. They remained concentrated in the traditional and declining industries. In the cities, domestic service became an important source of employment for women. The present situation. Impact of globalization and SAP. Women's employment has been affected by the worldwide imperialist offensive since the late 1970s and the pro-imperialist structural adjustment policies, SAP, introduced by the Indian government. On the one hand, there has been further retrenchment from industries, and on the other hand, there has been expansion of export-oriented production, especially in the unorganized sector that is employing large numbers of women. Hence, there has been a growth in the proportion of women employed in the non-household manufacturing sector in the 1980s. In the first period, after the comprador bourgeoisie came to power in India, while the organized sector expanded, women were marginalized. But in the present period, the organized manufacturing sector itself is under attack. the closure of thousands of factories, both in the public and private sectors in the decade of the 1980s, has thrown lakhs of workers, including women workers, out of jobs. In many cases, they have lost their lifelong savings and dues. Thousands of workers have been either forcibly retrenched or have been forced to give up their jobs through ploys like the VRS, Voluntary Retirement Scheme. Women have been targeted for this too. The Hindustan Lever case is a typical example of how this policy is being pursued by aggressive MNCs. Women's employment in the Sohri plant in Mumbai has been curtailed over the years. As part of their restructuring operations in the early 1980s, they targeted women. During the year-long lockout, they approached and forced women to accept the VRS, and finally, when the plant reopened, only 7 women workers remained in the plant. 150 women had accepted VRS. The policy of liberalization means that more and more jobs, even in big factories and offices, are being given out on contract and subcontract basis. Women are being employed in the lowest levels in these contract jobs, as temporary, casual workers. The growth of the export-oriented industries like garment and electronics, and the setting up of export promotion zones, has led to the employment of larger and larger numbers of women, especially school-educated girls in these factories. They're forced to work for low wages. There is an informal ban on unionization in these zones. Many of these industries are subcontractors for the imperialist companies, a part of their international division of labor. Globalization, the international division of labor introduced by the imperialists, means that these industries and contracts are completely dependent on the imperialists for their market and subject to their rapacity and exploitation. The burden of this exploitation is being borne by these workers. Globalization has also meant the decentralization of production, production being shifted out of large factories into workshops and homes. With computer-based technology, they have combined a highly centralized group of highly skilled workers with a large number of de-skilled, dispersed labor processes which require little capital investment. Thus, these nodules of parts of the production process itself are being contracted out to small units where the same product is manufactured under very different conditions of work. It is in these sweaty workshops that large numbers of women are being employed in larger cities. The imperialists have also introduced the putting out system once again. Highly divided parts of the production process are being given out to women to produce at home. Women, with the help of their children, work for long hours for a mere pittance. The wage is not even a subsistence wage enough for mere survival. Thousands of women in the vast slums of Mumbai, for example, are involved in sewing garments from their home, in manufacturing parts of jewelry, locks, clips, bindis, paper boxes, agarbattis, etc. They work with no tools or with the simplest. They now constitute the new unorganized sector, home-based workers being created by the SAP, women who do not even realize that they are workers. Women, especially third world women, are being considered as particularly suitable for this task. They constitute a cheap, docile labor force, which is willing to work long hours for extremely depressed wages. Since their work is considered as supplementary, and since they combine it with domestic responsibilities, it fits into the feudal patriarchal family norms. The imperialists are using the feudal patriarchal norms to extract labor with super profits from the third world woman, especially in the home-based sector. The main criteria for locating production in a particular place is the availability of cheap labor, so that the production can be shifted the moment cheaper labor is available elsewhere. The fact is that this kind of production, whether in workshops or at home, has a minimal amount of machinery, so closing or shifting production is extremely simple and entails no cost whatsoever. The women are being given work with no certainty of continuity of job security. Growth of the service sector. At the same time, women's employment in the service sector, in teaching jobs, as nurses and paramedical workers in the rural health schemes, and the ICDS project, as clerks in banking, insurance and government administration and telecommunications, has also grown in the past two decades. By 1984-85, 12.9% of working women were employed in the organized sector, of which the services sector itself accounted for 9.26%. This is a well-unionized sector. This sector, too, has been affected by the liberalization and privatization policies of the government, the reduction in government spending on education and health by computerization, etc. To protect their jobs and improve their service conditions, workers in this sector have taken up struggles, in which these women have also actively participated. The number of educated, unemployed women is growing by leaps and bounds. Thus, in these past two decades, the number and proportion of women in manufacturing has gone up, though they are concentrated in the unorganized sector. At the same time, the number of educated women finding employment in the service sector has become substantial, as they are concentrated in certain industries and occupations in the service sector. Women's role in the working class movement has once again become important. Gender-based discrimination. Yet, women in both the organized and unorganized sector are subject to exploitation on a gender basis as well. 1. Women are concentrated in the unorganized sector. The largest proportion of women are BD workers, handloom weavers, fish processing workers, vendors, matadi, headload carriers, workers, domestic servants. Wages are low, hours of work unregulated, and they have no job security or benefits. They have no chances of promotion. Work experience does not bring them better wages. 2. Feminization of certain occupations. Women are concentrated in certain low-skill, low-wage occupations. Their work is undervalued and wage rates are lower, e.g. choir industry, BD industry, domestic service, hand embroidery, nursing, primary school teaching are examples of female-dominated occupations. 3. Bias against women. Women are not allowed to handle sophisticated machinery and instruments because it is assumed that they cannot learn the necessary skills and technical knowledge. They are concentrated in industries with less capital investment. This is being reinforced by the policy of the government and social attitudes, since girls are not as educated as compared to boys, and also, technical institutes offer very few courses for girls and women. Most of the courses offered are those like stenotyping, data operating, cookery, beautician courses, which are considered suitable for women. 4. Wage discrimination. In spite of legislations like the Equal Remuneration Act, women get lower wages than men in many industries and jobs. Women earn less than men even in the same job. Often, unions too sign agreements that accept lower rates for women. Various indirect methods are also used to keep their wages lower, like keeping them piece-rated, casual, or temporary, lowering the categorization of their work. 5. Sexual harassment. Women employees and workers have to face sexual harassment from supervisors and seniors. 6. Discrimination. Pregnancy and motherhood, the social functions of women, have become levers in the hands of the comprador feudal government and private capitalists to harass and discriminate against women. While the concept of paternity leave has been accepted in developed countries, in India, women are still struggling to assert their right to motherhood. Pregnant women are not employed. They are retrenched during pregnancy. The government has also tried to link maternity benefits to marital status. This came to light in 1986 when a telephone operator from Bhuj was denied maternity leave because she was not married on the records of the department. Protests all over the country in a legal battle finally succeeded in forcing the government to withdraw its stand. The government reacted in typical feudal fashion that the provision is meant to protect the health of the mother and child. It was also an attempt to force women to change their surnames after marriage. The Fourth Pay Commission has also restricted the right by proposing that maternity benefits should be claimed only up to two births. Even the ESI Act has been amended so that this right is denied to a large number of contract and casual workers. 7. Health hazards. Many of the occupations in which women are employed are hazardous to health. Lack of information and lack of alternative employment forces women to continue in these occupations. 8. Lack of facilities like separate toilets, restrooms. This problem exists both in the organized and in the unorganized sector. Utter neglect of the special needs of women, lack of trained staff to handle children in creches, these problems are the lowest in the priority of trade unions and hence neglected. Struggles of women workers. The British period. The first part of the 20th century was marked by the awakening of the proletariat, especially in the period after the First World War. The severe exploitation of the workers during the war years, due to which the capitalists amassed massive profits, coupled with the growth of an anti-imperialist consciousness, led to a wave of worker struggles. Trade unions began to be formed in this period. Women workers, who formed a significant section of the young proletariat, played an active part in these struggles. They constituted a militant section of the working class in the colonial period, in the textile, jute, plantations, and mining industries. In the textile industry, too, women were active from the very inception. They faced severe, inhuman exploitation. Long working hours without any limits, without adequate breaks, poor working conditions, wages almost half that of men, and no provision for maternity benefits, etc. Due to this, women textile workers were active from the social reform period in the end of the 19th century. In Mumbai, when a social reformer, N.M. Lokande, began the Mill Hands Association in 1890, women workers also joined the association, attending and even addressing meetings of the association. The campaign of the textile workers of Bombay had its impact in getting the factory commission appointed in September 1890. Following the recommendations of the factory commission, the working hours of women were restricted to 11 hours and night work was prohibited for women. Later, when the trade union movement emerged among textile workers, women workers were also active and militant fighters. In the famous long strike in 1928, women were in the forefront of picketing at mill gates. Women workers and wives of men workers played an active role in the Sholapur uprising in May 1930. Textile workers had gone on strike to protest against the arrest of Gandhi during the civil disobedience movement. In retaliation against police firing on the striking workers, the workers burnt down police stations and the district court complex. The striking workers, joined by the general public, took control of the town. The British took 7 days to regain control of the town. They declared martial law and unleashed a very brutal campaign of repression. Working-class women displayed exemplary courage in this uprising. Through their struggles, women textile workers in Bombay were able to prevent their retrenchment in the 1930s. The International Socialist Women's Movement and the Third International led by Lenin raised several demands to protect women workers and to provide for their special needs. Ban on night work, ban on work in industries of processes hazardous to health, maternity leave, creches, separate toilet facilities, community kitchens, regular breaks for feeding babies were demands raised by the International Socialist Movement and implemented by the Bolsheviks after the Russian Revolution in the USSR. These became the demands of the international working class. Though the All India Trade Union movement too raised these demands, during the colonial period, only the ban on night work and underground work was legally enforced by the colonial British government. That too, partially, for during the Second World War, due to the needs of increasing production of coal, women were encouraged and made to work in the underground mines. It is only in the period after 1947 that the trade union movement succeeded in getting legislation enacted for equal wages, maternity benefits, and crèche facilities. The trade union movement emerged in the 1920s in the context of the anti-British movement. The mass of workers and peasants also began to participate in the movement. Hence, many of the petty bourgeois and bourgeois leaders and participants of the nationalist struggles kept links with the workers' movement, and some of the Marxist leaders became organizers and supporters of the trade union movement. It is in this context that Annie Besant was elected one of the three vice presidents of the AITUC at its founding conference in 1919. Many educated, middle-class women worked tirelessly among the workers as organizers and came to be recognized as leaders of the workers. In the Bombay province, Mani Benkata, a supporter of M.N. Roy, led the struggles of textile workers. A fiery orator, she was imprisoned for her speeches. Elected as the president of the AITUC in 1935, she remained active among workers all her life. Usha Tedange, the wife of the CPI leader S.A. Dange, was active among women textile workers from the 1928 strike itself. She led the eight-month-long struggle of the mill workers against retrenchment. The high point of their struggle was the night-long encirclement of the mill office by over 700 women workers. Usha Dange was also one of the organizers of the 1934 strike and remained associated with the workers' movement all her life. Parvati Bhore, a barber by caste, was a fiery speaker and participated in many struggles of textile workers. She was elected joint secretary of the Girni Kamgar Union. Meenakshi Sane, a member of the CPI, was sent to Sholapur by the party in 1934 to work among the workers who had earned a name through their militancy. She built up a movement among textile and bidi workers, with women playing a leading role. Shanta Palerao, a full-timer of the AITUC, was elected vice president of the AITUC. Noteworthy about these women was the fact that most of them remained active trade unionists all their life. In February 1946, during the militant general strikes in support of the Royal Indian Navy cadet uprising, almost 500 workers in Bombay were killed in police firings. Among these martyrs was one woman communist leader, Kamal Dande. In Bengal, too, several women, especially nationalist leaders, became leaders of the trade union movement. Among them was Santosh Kumari Devi, who led the jute workers from 1922 to 27 in the Gauripur Nehati region of the 24 Parganas, Prabhabhati Dasgupta, who led the struggle of the scavengers in Calcutta Municipal Corporation in 1928, and then the general strike of jute workers in 1929. Dr. Maitreyi Bose, a congresswoman, worked among dock and port workers. She joined the INTUC and was a prominent leader of the INTUC, a rare thing, considering that the INTUC has no tradition at all of promoting women into leadership. Communist women of various trends, too, were active among workers. Sudha Roy, a communist schoolteacher, worked among dock workers in the 1930s. Women workers in jute mills, and the plantations, too, made a name for themselves as militant organizers. Dukmati was active among the jute workers of the Baranagar area and led many militant agitations. She was a representative of the workers in AITUC and elected vice president of the Jute Workers Union. Sukumari Chowdhury was an active worker of Bengal lamps. Meli Chetri, a tea garden worker, led and organized the Dengaujhar Tea Garden in a long-drawn struggle in the repressive period of the late 1940s. She went underground, though she was pregnant, and led the striking workers from jungles. Succumbing to the extreme physical hardship, she died in 1949. There are many such unsung heroines of the working-class movement. There are few examples given to stress the point that women, as workers, and as politically active members of the anti-imperialist movement and the communist movement, played an active role in the working-class movement. But this history is hidden in the various specific struggles, and these could not be comprehensively documented for this paper. The average book on trade union history does not display any gender sensitivity and does not delve into this aspect of the working-class movement. To an extent, this is also a reflection of the weakness of the trade union movement itself, which drew women into the struggle, raised their demands, but did not conceptualize the significance of the woman's participation in modern industry. The problem of the double burden, and thereby devise strategies to counter the anti-woman maneuvers of the capitalist class. The post-1947 struggles involving women workers. This period, too, is marked initially by the major struggles in industries where women constitute a substantial number. Organizations of BD workers were active during the British period itself, but their struggles picked up momentum in the 1950s and 1960s, especially in Maharashtra, Karnataka, Kerala, and later in Andhra Pradesh. Choir workers in Kerala also led some militant struggles in the 1950s. They have also struggled against attempts to mechanize their work. In the 1970s and 1980s, casual and contract workers in the public sector, steel and heavy engineering plants and mines around the country, started getting organized and participated in militant struggles to get maximum wages for regularization, implementation of provisions like PF, gratuity, bonus, etc. Women contract and casual workers have been very much part of these struggles. It was due to the agitations of BD workers that the BD and Cigar Conditions of Employment Act of 1966 was enacted. This act provides for paid weekly holiday, annual leave, and maternity benefits to all the workers, including home-based workers. Many of these struggles have been subject to severe police repression, but both women workers and the wives of striking workers have braved brutal repression to continue the struggle. The wives of railway workers braved repression to sit on the rail tracks to prevent the paramilitary from running trains during the famous All India Railway strike in May 1974. The workers in the iron ore mines of Dalirachara began their attempts to form a separate union by facing police firing in 1977. The women textile workers and women family members of the striking workers participated in the Rastaroko and Jail Bharo during the longest textile strike in Mumbai in 1982. One woman was martyred in this Jail Bharo. Women workers from SEEPS in Bombay faced detention in jail when they militantly gheraud a minister in his bungalow. Such accounts are innumerable and go to show that women workers are still as militant and willing to face the most brutal repression in order to fight their exploitation and get justice. Since the late 1970s, organizations of workers and employees in the various service sector industries have also started growing. School and college teachers, nurses, government employees, etc., have been involved in struggle. The militancy of women school teachers during the statewide strike in Tamil Nadu made news all over the country. It is women in this sector who have struggled, individually and collectively, against discriminatory practices and sexual harassment. The struggle of air hostesses against being permanently grounded on attaining the age of 30 or on becoming pregnant, the struggle of nursing students in Raipur and other cities against the virginity tests, are examples of these struggles. Women employees in the Anganwadis under the ICDS scheme have got unionized and have put up statewide and even an All India agitation to get regularized and get a regular salary instead of the miserable wages they were being given. In the unorganized sector too, women have slowly started organizing themselves. The widespread organization of the Tendu leaf pickers in the forests of central India, under the leadership of the DAKMS and COMS in the past decade and a half, has succeeded in substantially increasing the wages of the workers. Women and men bamboo workers, Burad, in Bandara district, have also faced police repression to demand regular supply of bamboo at low rates from the forest department. Among the reformist attempts to organize women in the self-employed sector, the most famous is Seva, started by Ilabhat in Aminabad. Starting as a union of headload workers, it has grown into an institution providing credit, medical training, etc. Yet the vast masses of women in the unorganized sector are yet to be organized. While women have been militant and consistent during struggle, their participation in regular trade union activities and in taking leadership in trade unions is low. Some union women have functioned as unit leaders or have become members of local committees, but few are found in responsible positions at the higher level. The neglect of the special problems of women by trade unions remains the single most important reason for this. The tradition of women trade unionists still continues in Maharashtra even up to the present period. Most of them have been middle-class women working among the unorganized sectors of workers. The oldest among them at present is Sundar Navalkar. A labor lawyer, she was arrested in the early 1970s for her association with the ML movement and sentenced for 3 years. She has worked among construction workers all her life. Role of trade unions and communist movement. An analysis. The trade union movement in India has to take the prime responsibility for the dismal condition of women workers in the industrial sector, for their marginalization, and their concentration in the low-paid, insecure, informal sector, their low participation in trade union activities and meetings. While the trade union movement is splintered on the basis of alignment to the various ruling class parties, the communist movement has had a major impact on the trade union movement. The CPI worked hard to build up militant struggles of workers and formed unions of workers in all major industries at that time. The working class also played an active role in the anti-imperialist struggle, but the weakness in the political line of the party at that time prevented the proletariat from taking the leadership of the anti-imperialist movement. The weakness of the political and organizational line of the CPI had its bearing on the questions of women's oppression too. In spite of leading women workers in bitter struggle, and even building up leadership among women, the CPI did not pay serious attention to the question of women's participation in modern industrial production. It did not conceptualize the gender bias that operated in industry, the ways in which the imperialists and the local candidates use a patriarchal system to keep women's labor value depressed, and hence, they did not devise steps to counter these strategies of the capitalists and the British rulers. Organizationally, too, no specific steps were taken to create organizational forms through which women workers could be given special attention. During the course of the Russian Revolution, the Bolsheviks used many organizational forms, like subcommittees, bureaus, etc., for organizing women workers. Though in the late 1920s, Dange, the leader of the CPI in the textile movement in Bombay, mooted the idea of separate cells for women workers within the unions, there is no evidence of concrete steps taken to form such groups on a systematic basis. 50 years later, in 1987, A.B. Bardhan, the General Secretary of AITUC, and presently Secretary of the CPI, wrote, quote, "There is only a sprinkling of women delegates in trade union conferences at various levels. Even when women workers are in overwhelming numbers, as, for example, in BD or choir industry, it is men who represent them as delegates at conferences. Executive committees and office bearers of the TU rarely have women among them," end quote. It is an admission of the fact that they failed to involve women workers. In spite of many weaknesses in political and organizational line, in the British period, much work was done among women workers. But the major change came in the political line of the party after 1950. The CPI upheld the so-called independence of India, hailed the rule of the Compradore feudal classes, and the rule of the anti-imperialist national bourgeoisie under the leadership of Nehru, and then began a process of cooperation with the ruling classes. It gave up armed struggle and the path to liberate the Indian masses, and placed their entire political work within the framework of the parliamentary system. The trade union movement was also affected by this line, e.g., CPI-led unions have defended the public sector as a form of socialistic enterprise, overlooking the fact that this is a form of Compradore bureaucrat capital. They have ignored the growth of the contract system in these industries, overlooked actualization, etc., and done next to nothing to make the permanent employees take up the cause of the unorganized sections in these plants. They took no steps to prevent the massive retrenchment of women from the industries where they had a base, like coal mines and textiles. Having compromised with the Compradore feudal ruling classes, and even defending their repressive policies, 1975-77, The CPI-led unions are not in the forefront of the fight against the new offensive of the imperialists and globalization. The Women's Front of the CPI, formed in 1954, the NFIW, has been primarily based among the middle-class woman, though it has a mass membership, and its focus has been taking up the general issues of women and children and women's rights. In the late 1940s, the CPI-led woman organized some conferences of working women, Shramik Mahila Parishad, but this was not followed up. The next systematic attempt to bring working women on a platform and highlight their problems was taken by CITU in 1979. They organized a convention of working women in Madras that year. This was followed up by the formation of the All India Coordination Committee of Working Women, AICCWW, at the center with some state units. The AICCWW has organized three conventions, the first in 1981, the second in Delhi in 1984, and the third convention was organized at Calcutta in 1991. The main aim of the AICCWW was to promote the recruitment of women in unions, take up their problems, and promote women in the higher committees of the union. Vimala Ranadive, the general secretary of the AICCWW, presenting her report to CITU in 1987, said that, quote, "The trade union movement has to fight its feudal tendencies as a part of the working class struggle. Women in thousands participated in strikes, faced jails and repression, went through all the privations with men employees. Unfortunately, the working class and their unions did not pay attention to their specific problems, nor fight for their demands like retrenchment, provision of creches," end quote. Reviewing the progress made in the 7 years, she reported that, quote, "After initial gains in the beginning after 1979, a stagnation period began during the last 3 to 4 years, and committees formed became non-functioning or inactive," end quote. The main tasks undertaken by the AICCWW was to popularize a charter of demands for working women and mobilize women for a political call at an all-India level. From the reports, the Tamil Nadu unit put the maximum effort to organize various conventions of working women and draw them into their unions. The West Bengal unit concentrated on promoting women's leadership, a necessity in order to consolidate the base of the ruling CPM government. In Maharashtra, in spite of a higher participation rate of women in industry and services sector, this coordination of working women, even as a joint front effort, was not successful after the first convention. But the revisionist line of the CITU, in keeping with its affiliation to the CPM, is developing a narrow, economistic consciousness among working women. Since they are not willing to lead an uncompromising struggle with the pro-imperialist central government, and in the states ruled by them, they are themselves inviting the imperialists, the CPM-led CITU cannot fight the policies that have brought so many miseries to the Indian woman, and draw her into leadership to fulfill her historical task, along with the male contingent of the proletariat, to liberate the Indian masses from the shackles of imperialism and feudalism. In West Bengal, they have curtailed unions from vigorously fighting the imperialist offensive and rapacious policies of private jute mill owners. On the other hand, the spark of Naxalbari has inspired many women to break down the rigid barriers of class and gender and work with a revolutionary perspective among workers. Girl students joined factories as workers to organize them. Later, as the Marxist-Leninist ML movement has grown, women professional revolutionaries took up jobs as part of a plan to organize women workers and bring them into the struggle. Comrades Swarnalata and Swarupa, who were martyred, fulfilled this task as part of the many activities they undertook in the course of their revolutionary work. The ML movement has also taken up the demand for equal wages for women and men workers and succeeded in getting it implemented in the struggle areas in Vidarbha, Bastar, and Telangana. Women workers working in the Public Works Department, for the Force Department, and other government departments have particularly gained from these struggles. The various trends of the ML movement have also generated several women trade union organizers and leaders, especially in Maharashtra. Women who have worked not only with women workers, but also with coal mine workers, construction workers, press workers, and general factory workers. The main struggles of BD workers and their organizations have been built up by revolutionary forces in Andhra Pradesh. But on the whole, these efforts have, as yet, only touched a small part of the working class, especially women workers. The task of organizing women workers and employees from the revolutionary perspective, of making women full participants in the working class struggle, and the struggle to emancipate women, has only begun. This is not merely a question of gaining formal positions of authority in the trade union movement, but giving the trade union movement an orientation, so that traditional barriers and attitudes that are keeping women away from active participation are fought, and at the same time, the calls to radically restructure family responsibilities so that the double burden on women is eased become the calls of the entire working class movement. A debate. Protection versus formal equality. Meanwhile, in the light of the worldwide changes that have taken place, various discussions have emerged about what is the best way forward for working women to achieve parity and equality. In the beginning of this century, the socialist women's movement pressed for certain demands to protect the health and interest of working women and children. Ban on night shifts for women, ban on work that is hazardous, restrictions on carrying loads, provision of creches and maternity leave, and wage parity. The word over these demands were legally accepted, though its implementation is very limited. The world over, these demands were legally accepted, though its implementation is very limited. But these protective provisions are now being considered as obstacles to the wider employment of women. Employers have raised the bogey that they cannot bear the burden of these provisions, and they should be scrapped. Some women activists are veering to this position indirectly. They point out that women in the unorganized sector carry extremely heavy loads, do not get any facilities or maternity benefits, etc. The government is hypocritical regarding giving protection to women. They argue that instead of banning only women's work in hazardous industries, it should be banned for all workers, similarly for night work. The same question has come up before in the international working class movement. In Japan, for example, it was argued around the Equal Opportunity Law. The decade of the 1970s and 1980s witnessed rapid entry of women into the workforce, and now they constitute over 35% of the workforce. Increasingly, they are being absorbed as temporary, home-based, and part-time workers, and paid much lower wages. In response to the demand of the woman for more economic opportunities in the 1970s, Japanese capitalism said that women workers were overprotected due to regulations. Women's protection is obstructive. Lack of skills, physical handicaps like menstruation, delivery, and childcare, as well as legal regulations like limit to overtime work, night work restrictions, were preventing women from being absorbed into the workforce. Hence, the Japanese capitalist class argued that protective measures reinforce discrimination against women in the workplace. They recommended that there should be legal equality from hiring to dismissal stage. Protection for maternity should be reinforced, but all other protective regulations should be eliminated. The World Bank is giving similar arguments too. On this basis, the Equal Opportunity Law was passed in Japan in 1985 amidst a debate of protection versus equality. This debate has become a worldwide discussion. However, protection cannot be considered as discrimination. Women's groups are also demanding that what women need is not equal opportunity law, but equality as a result, i.e., the creation of positive conditions so that women can actually exercise their right to work. Women need substantial equality, not merely formal equality. The Equal Opportunity Law has made the conditions for Japanese women workers even harder, because if they choose to compete on equal terms, they are thrown into the most severe competition with men, overtime is forced, and they have no special provisions to handle or overcome their specific problems. Women who do not choose equal opportunity are forced to accept discrimination in job chances and lower wages. Imperialism is bound to bring the Japanese experience to India in different forms. So the women's movement must be prepared to confront the insidious way in which, in the name of equality, discrimination against women is sought to be justified. In several occupations like nursing, telecommunications, and the press, night shift is accepted for women employees. Gradually, the trade union movement has demanded and obtained facilities like restrooms and transport for the employees involved in night work. The Norwegian Women's Movement and Revolutionary Working Class Movement is demanding 6-hour working days so that women can participate equally and men can share domestic responsibilities. Conclusion. If women have to gain equality in the economic sphere, women's role in the manufacturing sector needs to rise substantially. At the same time, strategic demands, which will go toward altering the traditional division of labor in the family, i.e. the burden of childcare and domestic work, need also to be immediately placed as demands of the entire working class movement. The tasks before the working class women's movement in cooperation with the women's movement are formidable but urgent. 1. The imperialist offensive and policy of globalization should be exposed and opposed. This is particularly necessary in the informal sector. Women must realize the cause of their poverty, i.e., the undervaluation of their labor. At the same time, they must learn to value their own labor and consider it for what it actually is, a substantial portion of the family income, not supplementary or secondary. Without this, the task of organizing working women, especially in the unorganized sector, cannot be successfully undertaken. 2. Women in the workshop-based, home-based industries need to be organized to demand that all labor laws and facilities, like ESI, Provident Fund, maternity benefits, etc., are extended to them and they are recognized as workers. This is a task before urban-based women's organizations, too, to lend a hand in organizing these women. 3. Put pressure on the organized industry unions to support and help the casual, temporary, contract, subcontract workers connected with their concern or industry to get organized and to defend their rights. In fact, in order to protect their conditions in organized industries, it has become essential to organize these sections and to struggle against attempts of management to contract out work of all kind, whether it is cleaning and maintenance or the running of canteens, or parts of the production itself. 4. In organized industries and offices too, the need to take up the specific demands of women in organized industries and offices too, there is a need to take up the specific demands of women, and there is an urgent need for women to become active on their specific issues, which include provisions of toilets and restrooms, promotional opportunities, training and skill upgrading opportunities, transport, medical facilities, extended maternity leave facilities, etc. Women themselves need to become active on these issues and cannot wait for male trade union leaders to become sensitive to and take up their issues. 5. Cases of sexual harassment at work also must be exposed and fought. 6. The demand for crèche facilities needs to be reformulated. Crèche facilities should be available in all establishments, irrespective of whether women are employed or not. This will encourage fathers to also take responsibilities of children. 7. Men should be provided paternity leave. 8. The demand for community kitchens/subsidized canteens, adequate toilet facilities in industrial belts and estates also need to be raised. 9. Hostels for working women, a long-standing demand of the women's movement, have to be vigorously put forward. Only then, women can leave the confines of the family and go forward to seek employment and a career. 10. Oppose all proposals for part-time/flexi-time work, since experience has shown that it is a means to deprive women of full income and job security. It does not, as the European experience shows, help to organize housework better either. Women find they have to work harder and find that the flexible timings make it difficult to organize crèches, shopping, banking, etc.